Rupert Sheldrake studied natural sciences at Cambridge, philosophy at Harvard. He received a Ph.D. in biochemistry at Cambridge and was a fellow of Clare College, Cambridge, and a research fellow of the Royal Society. Rupert is the author of more than 60 scientific papers and several books based on the results from 4,000 case histories, 2,000 questionnaires, 1,500 telephone interviews, and a decade of experiments into unusual and unexplained perceptiveness in humans. Sheldrake makes a compelling case that intuition, precognition, and telepathy are not paranormal, but are in fact normal functions drawn from our own biological past. He uses experiments with the sense of being stared at to advantage his theory that the mind extends beyond the brain and actually connects with the images and beings that we perceive. For Sheldrake, once the influence of the mind is admitted to extend beyond the head, many puzzling phenomena, including telepathy, mind over matter, phantom limbs, and much, much more, begin to make sense. This is going to be a fascinating night, and he is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Rupert, welcome. How are you?
Hello, I'm fine, thanks.
How did you get interested in the studies of what we're going to be talking about tonight? What happened to you to get interested in that?
Well, of course, I'd had some of these experiences myself, but so have most people, so that's not a particularly special reason why I got interested. I think the main reason was that for a variety of reasons I came to the conclusion that science as we know it is very limited, and I came to experience it as increasingly dogmatic with a kind of tunnel vision. And I strongly believe in the scientific method, but I don't believe in the kind of dogmatism I found all around me. And I found so many phenomena. The minute I opened my eyes and began to look, I saw phenomena all around which didn't seem to be explained, and yet which seemed to be capable of scientific explanation. I like doing experiments, and for years I've been designing experiments, I mean for decades. So I think a key point for me was when I saw that you could actually do quite simple experiments to resolve some of these controversial questions, like, does the sense of being stared at really happen? Can people really tell when someone's calling on the phone? They often have that kind of telepathic feeling that they know who's calling. I found a lot of these things had simply not been investigated, and when I realized they could be, I got really excited. I mean, here's a whole new area of science that could open up.
You know, sometimes people even are so intuitive that they can feel the phone that it's going to ring before it even occurs.
Oh, yes. And it's quite common, actually. We've done surveys that show that there's about 80% of the population have had the experience of thinking of someone for no apparent reason. Then the person calls, and then they say, oh, that's funny, I was just thinking about you. Very, very common, these experiences. Some people have them several times a week. So this is one of the areas that I got very interested in. Of course, as soon as you mention it to someone of a standard skeptical cast of mind, what they say is, well, you think about other people all the time. Occasionally someone rings by chance, and you then think it's telepathic.
Mm-hmm.
You forget
mm-hmm.
all the times you're wrong. Well, for years I was persuaded by that kind of armchair argument. But then when I began to think about it, I thought, well, is there any actual evidence for this theory? It's not unreasonable. But the amazing thing is that this skeptical theory, is most scientists will say it if pressed, but they accept it on the basis of no evidence at all. I discovered there'd been no experiments of any kind by anybody on this phenomenon. So it's astonishing how easily skeptical arguments are accepted without any kind of critical examination if they agree with a kind of majority point of view in science. Then I thought, well, this is something we need to test. We can actually do experiments. And I've been doing a lot of experiments on this particular phenomenon, and the experiments show that people really can tell who's calling before they pick up the phone.
I find this to be so fascinating, because would you even put this into this category where you're thinking about somebody? Let's say you're walking down the street, you turn around the corner of a building, Rupert, and you run right into them. Is that almost the same kind of thing?
Well, I wish I knew. That's a very, very interesting phenomenon. I mean, I've collected, as you know, a lot of case histories.
Yes,
and
yes.
Many people have had this kind of experience. And it's something, I've discussed it with parapsychologists and psychical researchers, and there isn't a name for it, and it doesn't seem to have been classified. And it's hard to know quite what kind of experience it is, because telepathy normally involves one person thinking about the other and the other person picking up their intention.
Yes.
Now, in the case where you walk round the corner and you run into someone you haven't seen for a while unexpectedly, you're not thinking about them, or at least if you are, it's only because of this phenomenon. They're not thinking about you, generally speaking. They're just going about their normal life. That's very unlike the telephone telepathy case, where when you think of somebody, they're actually planning to call you, looking up the number, dialing it, and so forth. They've got you in mind when you think of them, typically. But in this bumping into people phenomenon, they're not thinking about you. So it's not clearly telepathic. I think it's more likely to be some kind of precognition, knowing in advance or feeling in advance that something's going to happen.
I know a case, I know it so well because it's happening to me, I'm the person, that when I'm talking to a particular person, another person who is a very close friend of mine will call that person in you know, here we have call waiting, which gives people the ability to say, hold on, let me get this other call. This other person always calls, but it's not the same time. No matter what time I'm talking to this other individual on the phone, it could be 7 o'clock in the afternoon, at night, it could be 6 o'clock in the morning, it doesn't matter. The other person involved always seems to call when I'm on the phone with that other person. It's uncanny, and I just can't figure out why until I started seeing what you've written. And I'm saying there's got to be a connection here.
Yes, yes. I mean, I suppose, I mean, is there some kind of emotional, is the person who calls, is there an emotional connection with you or your friend?
I think so. I think that's very fair to say that.
I mean, it usually happens, telepathy isn't always based on conscious intention. It also involves picking up emotional changes in people you know. For example, a lot of mothers find that they suddenly get worried about their kid. They call home or they go home and there's been an accident. And in that kind of case, there's an emotional change in the other person that they've picked up. And there are even cases where telepathy works in an embarrassing way for people, where partners pick up their sexual infidelities on the part of their partner, and you know that something's happening. I mean, just know it, and sometimes even get some of the details.
Oh my!
I mean, it doesn't always happen, of course, but when it does, it's deeply embarrassing and upsetting. And that's certainly not a case of conscious projection of intention. So telepathy really involves, like, what it literally means, telepathy, is distant feeling, tele, distant, like in telephone, television, and pathy, feeling, like in empathy or sympathy.
Now, when you talk about the sense of being stared at, are you talking primarily about the person who feels that person or somebody staring at them, or is it also a case where someone is concentrating, saying, I'm going to stare at this person until they turn around and look at me? Does it work that way, too?
It does, yes. I mean, normally it works where people aren't particularly trying to make the person turn around. I mean, very often people look at each other with curiosity, or someone might look at someone out of curiosity. They may vaguely want them to turn around, and they do. Sometimes people don't intend to make them turn around, and when they do, it's embarrassing because they see them looking at them.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately have to look away. There are cases where people deliberately do it. For example, a woman told me just yesterday that she was in her office looking out of the window. There was a colleague sitting in a car outside with her back to her. She wanted to get her attention. She wanted to tell her something before she drove off home. So she stared at the back of her head, willing her to turn around, and sure enough, in about half a minute, this woman did turn around, saw her, she caught her eye, she waved to her, and they made contact. In that case, it was quite deliberate.
Right.
I mean, there are cases where people are immune to this. I often feel here in England that waiters are particularly immune to this. You can stare at them as much as you like, wanting them to turn around. Seem to have developed a kind of
a force field,
protective skin.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I find the American ones more attentive and responsive, actually. They seem particularly immune to being stared at here in England.
And that's a good issue. Are there regions of this planet where certain peoples tend to be a little more receptive than other people?
Well, I think there are. I think that, you know, all of us who live in cities are seen by so many people all the time. You know, when I walk down the street in London, I mean, there's thousands of people in the streets, or if I travel on the London Underground, the subway, you know, there are so many people there that we need to develop a kind of immunity to this because we're looked at by so many strangers all the time. I found when I lived in India, and I found that when I lived in rural India, when I was going into villages and that sort of thing, the people there seem very much more sensitive, and I think it's partly because, you know, in rural areas there's just fewer people looking. You become more sensitive. You don't need to build up this kind of immunity or defense against it.
When you did the study of people having the perception that they're being looked at, did anything really specifically happen to you where you said, I'm going to do a study on this? And then how do you go about doing a study on something like that?
Well, I think what made me want to do the study was I'd had the experiences, of course, of being looked at, but so have most other people.
Sure.
What made me get interested in the study was I was thinking about how the mind works, and specifically I was thinking about how vision works, and even more specifically thinking about predators and prey. And I was thinking about the way when predators focus on their prey.
Human or otherwise, I guess, right?
Pardon?
Human or otherwise.
Yes, human or otherwise. I was actually thinking more of animals at the time. If the prey could detect this, if the predator had a kind of field of influence that went out to touch the prey, and if the prey could detect it, then they could escape, and it would be a useful ability. And then I realized the sense of being stared at was a common phenomenon, and then I realized that it had huge implications for understanding the nature of the mind, the nature of vision. And then I asked around, and I found that there had been virtually no studies on it, although almost everyone's experienced it. Even parapsychologists had almost completely ignored it. So there seemed to be, as it were, a blind spot about this thing to do with vision, a kind of paradoxical situation where no one was investigating something that's terribly well known. So I thought that that's interesting. The very fact there's been such a taboo against thinking about it is itself interesting. And then I started my investigation. Most of my investigations begin by asking people what they've experienced, starting from the natural history of what's going on. And I have hundreds of cases of where people have described to me these sensations. So then I did questionnaires to find out what circumstances it happens in. Does it happen more with strangers or familiar people?
Mm-hmm.
Is it more in the street or public places? Or where? So I built up a picture of the natural history, and then I moved into doing experiments.
How about women versus men in terms of perception and children? Is there a difference?
Well, the evidence we have so far suggests that children are more sensitive than adults. And that's one reason why I've done quite a lot of my experiments in schools.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because teachers are generally quite open to this phenomenon. Most of them are well aware of the feeling of being stared at. In fact, it's part of the stock in trade of a teacher, you know, to control a class by the power of the looks, particularly naughty children at the back, you know, just stare at them and they'll soon turn around and become aware of it. So teachers are into this, a lot of them, and children are quite sensitive. Among adults, I think women are more sensitive than men, but men are pretty sensitive as well in this one. It's more common for men to be the lookers. Actually, there's a sex difference shows up in these surveys quite often. More women than men have experienced being stared at. more men than women have experienced making people turn around, which, when you think of real life, makes sense. So, yes, there are differences. I mean, there are differences in different cultures, there are individual differences, differences between grown-ups and children. But even given all these differences, this is something that still affects the great majority of the population. I mean, I haven't found any groups where it's almost unknown. Practically every group I've ever talked to, questioned, or discussed it with is very familiar with this phenomenon.
Rupert, I've been with people, women especially, when you go into a room, they will say to me, why is everybody looking at me? Now, they're not looking around, they're not staring at other people, but they say that. And if I look around, or if someone else who might be with someone who says that looks around, of course, people seem to be staring at them. Is that the same kind of mechanism here we're talking about, where they perceive this, they feel this? It's almost like a vibration or something when they just walk into a room.
Yes, well, of course, people may all really be staring at them for, you know, they may be very beautiful, glamorous, famous, etc. There could be lots of reasons why people would want to stare at them. Yes, I mean, I think it's particularly interesting for people who are in the public eye, as we say, that they probably become quite sensitive to this, and of course a lot of people really do look at them. Yes, I mean, some people become extremely sensitive, and Princess Diana apparently was extremely sensitive to this. She hated being photographed by celebrity photographers, paparazzi, and I've interviewed some of Britain's leading celebrity photographers, and most of them are convinced that they could be looking at Princess Diana through from half a mile away, through a telescopic lens. They were hidden, and yet she'd pick it up. They said she was extremely sensitive, and she herself said she could smell a photographer from a mile away. She seemed to pick it up straight away and know which direction they were in. So some people can actually become extremely sensitive to this, and if they have a motive, most of us don't have the motive. She did, because she just hated this constant intrusion by photographers.
How ironic. It was the fleeing of the paparazzi that ended up being her undoing.
Yes. Yes. So, anyway, this sensitivity can develop, and I think a lot of people, celebrities in particular, ones who don't like to be photographed, do develop this, and celebrity photographers notice it. Actually, wildlife photographers notice it too. I've interviewed a lot of them, and when they're photographing animals, even if they're in a blind, and even if they're looking through a telescopic lens, a lot of animals seem to be able to pick it up.
All right. Rupert, one of our listeners said that you were a prime inspiration for him. He wrote a small book called Mr. Humphrey's School of Magic, based on some of the things that you were able to motivate him for, and he just wanted you to know that.
Thank you.
And you talk about the existence of what you say are morphic fields. Tell me a little bit about that. What are they?
Well, the basic idea is that in self-organizing systems, which include cells, tissues, animals, plants, and social groups, the wholeness of the system, that's more than the sum of the parts, depends on an organizing field, which I call a morphic field. The word morphic comes from the Greek word morphe, meaning form. And it's the same root that gives morphing, you know, when you change a picture from one to another,
right,
you change of shape. So morphic fields are to do with organization, pattern, and structure. The idea first came about in the 1920s in relation to growing plants and animals. The idea there's a kind of field that molds the developing organism. Fields are structures in space, like a magnetic field around a magnet. There's a pattern that the iron filings will take up if you scatter them around a magnet. And those reveal the invisible pattern that's there in space caused by the magnetic field. The idea is that living organisms have fields within and around them. They're not the same as magnetic or electrical fields. They're another kind of field. And we already know of several kinds of field in nature, like the gravitational field, the magnetic field, and then the fields of quantum field theory. This is another kind of field, and what they do is organize living systems. They organize the activity of the nervous system by imposing patterns on events that are otherwise probabilistic or indeterminate. And they organize the activity of our minds and our perception. They also organize social groups. And it's because the morphic fields underlie our mental activity that I think the fields stretch out beyond the brain. They're not just in the brain. I think that's one a basis for the sense of being stared at. The fields of social groups that coordinate the behavior of groups of animals like flocks of birds, schools of fish, packs of wolves, connect together the members of a social group, and I think that aspect of morphic fields underlies phenomena of telepathy. So I think these fields enable us to understand a whole range of phenomena which otherwise seem quite inexplicable, but make perfectly good sense when seen in terms of these fields.
Are the fields connected between, let's say, the person who's doing the staring and the person who actually feels someone staring at them? Are they connected?
Yes, I think they are. I think that when the person is being stared at, the morphic field of the person who's doing the looking, the field stretches out through. It's actually coupled to the electromagnetic field, so it's linked to the light. If you look at somebody through a mirror, they can still tell when they're being looked at. We've actually done experiments on this. So the field stretches out, and it's as if our attention focuses itself on what we're looking at. And I think there's a real field of attention that's coming out when you look at somebody, and that's what they detect. And that's how the sense of being stared at works.
Is it almost like an invisible fiber optic between several people or a number of people?
You could say that. I mean, some people use the term eye beam. It's as if a beam comes out of your eye as well as the light going in. And this, when it touches what you're looking at, can affect what you're looking at. That means that we can affect people or possibly even things just by looking at them. And of course, people and animals are the most sensitive, and it's through people and animals that I've been doing my research on this phenomenon.
When you were doing the research, tell me a little bit about how you conducted it in terms of scientifically.
Well, the experiments that I do are mostly a very simple nature. They're easy ones anyone can do, and in fact, anyone who's interested can do them on my website. How they work is people work in pairs. One person wears a blindfold. I use those airline-style blindfolds because they cut out peripheral vision.
Mm-hmm.
The person with the blindfold, the subject, sits comfortably. The other person who does the staring sits behind them, and they can be quite a considerable distance behind them. And then how the trial works is there's a random series of trials where the person behind either stares at the back of the neck of the person with the blindfold on, the subject, or they look away and think of something else. And this happens in a random sequence. You can either use random number tables, random number generators, toss a coin, but it has to be a truly random sequence. Then the person, there's a signal to indicate when the trial begins. I use a clicker or a beeper. So you hear a click, you're sitting there, if you're the subject, you know a trial's begun, and you have to guess looking or not looking. You guess if you're being stared at.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it only takes 5-10 seconds to guess. And you're right or you're wrong. And by chance, it's 50-50. You'd be right 50%
exactly,
of the time.
Yeah.
In fact, in the looking trials, on average, people are right 60% of the time, which is far above chance. If it's just a few trials, it's not necessarily above chance. But when you do it in thousands or even hundreds of thousands of trials, which we now, in fact, have done, then this becomes massively significant statistically. It seems to be a quite repeatable thing. Not everyone gets it right. Not everyone's equally sensitive. And some people do much better than that, but this 60% figure is the average for everybody.
What makes some people better than others in terms of their intuition or their perception?
I'm not sure. That's not something I've looked into very much. I think that there certainly are differences. I mean, there are, of course, there are differences in people's sensitivity to everything else. Some people have better hearing or smell than others.
You're right.
So people differ in this ability. We also, all of us differ according to circumstances. If you're sitting feeling very secure, talking to somebody, your attention's engaged, you're in a safe place, you'll probably be quite insensitive to this in real life. If you're walking down a dark street in a dangerous part of town at night, you'll probably become extremely sensitive and when you're much more vigilant. So people's individual sensitivity varies according to the circumstances. So I haven't done much research, though, on what makes the differences in sensitivity, because my main aim so far has been to establish that this phenomenon really happens. And then the next stage is to find out more details as to under what circumstances, how, etc.
In some of your experiments, Rupert, do you recall any individual who might have had a tremendous success percentage?
Yes, I mean, several come to mind. I mean, there's one, the most systematic attempt at this was done by a school teacher in Germany who took up these experiments at my suggestion. And then he went further than I'd been able to go in schools, because being a teacher, he was there all the time. And he found a group of children who were particularly sensitive, and he ran tests with them quite repeatedly. He gave them feedback during the trials, so they had a chance to learn, like in biofeedback, and improve their sensitivity. And some of them ended up being correct about 90% of the time, which is some of the most successful in all these experiments.
Yes, that's huge. Huge statistics there.
Yes. And otherwise, the people I've found, I found two people in tests I was doing who were phenomenally good at this. And I asked them why they thought this was so. It so happened both of them came from Eastern Europe. Both of them had grown up under the communist regime. And both of them said, where we come from, you know, it really mattered to know when you were being looked at. So that was a very interesting thing, that people who live in police states, where there's a lot of surveillance and a lot of fear of surveillance, may develop this to a greater degree than people elsewhere. Of course, I've never been able to do these tests in systematically in different countries, and in Eastern Europe now they're not police states anymore, but there are still plenty of police states left in the world, unfortunately. So that might be one thing, and through force of circumstance, people become more sensitive. Also, criminals become more sensitive. I've spoken to a lot of police officers and surveillance officers, and they say that people who are particularly concerned about being looked at, criminals, become what they call security conscious, and develop a particular sensitivity, and you can see why. I mean, it would obviously pay off. I have, in fact, done some experiments in jails. Of course, the people who are in jails are probably the criminals who didn't have it quite well developed enough, otherwise they wouldn't be in the jail. But I've found some pretty sensitive people in jails. I ran a series of tests in a woman's prison in Germany. I mean, I personally couldn't do it, but I had a research assistant, actually, who she was in prison, so she was able to carry out these experiments for me in the prison.
Do these same people, are they pretty perceptive or intuitive in terms of psychic ability, foreseeing events, for example?
Well, I don't know. I haven't done a survey of that among people, among prisoners, or among people who live under conditions of surveillance in police states. But it might well be so. I think a lot of people whose lives depend on intuitions do become more sensitive. I think that applies to a lot of business people, too. You know, if you're in business and you have to make decisions, you have to make them quick, and you have to make them on the basis of incomplete evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think intuition is quite common among successful business people. And that's a very different world, the academic world. You know, professors don't necessarily need to be very intuitive. A lot of them are not very intuitive. But I've found in the business world, a lot of business people easily will talk quite readily about these things, and many of them do have a kind of intuitive sense themselves, a hunch of when to buy things or sell things if they're in the stock markets. So I think there's a great deal of it around in real life, and I think that these abilities are not just on the margins of human psychology. I think they're of fundamental importance in the way we lead our lives.
Do you believe
our educational system at the moment does nothing to encourage them?
That's a good point. There should be classes in schools that really help get this kind of ability out.
Yes, I think these senses, the sixth sense or the seventh sense that we have, the reason we have them is I think they've evolved because they're useful. I think our animal ancestors have these things because they're useful, and they're things that, you know, are part of our biological nature for good reason, and those good reasons are still around in the modern world.
Do you believe that successful people are people who possess this ability more so than people who are not? Is it almost a trait?
I don't know. I've not. It depends what walk of life. I think success in speculative business, where you have to make decisions based on incomplete information, probably I would expect more than average there. These abilities are also, they're best developed in women, in fact. I mean, it's a common cliche that women are more intuitive, but all my surveys and experiments have suggested that's true. And I think that there are a lot of women who are very intuitive, and one way they use it is in their relations with children, you know, knowing when their kid needs them. I've done a whole lot of studies on breastfeeding mothers. Can they react telepathically to their baby's needs? The reason I did this was because a lot of mothers told me that they did. They said that they'd know when their baby needed them because their milk would let down. That's when women are nursing. The milk letdown reflex, mediated by a hormone called oxytocin, what happens is the breasts typically tingle and milk starts being squeezed out, the nipples leak. This is something that happens when a mother hears her baby cry. But sometimes women who are away from their baby, they may be shopping in a supermarket or a cocktail party or something, they feel their milk letdown, even though it's not a normal feeding time for the baby. Such women either go home or they call home because they know that the baby needs them. And I've done an actual study, a controlled study on this, where we've shown that it does in fact happen far more than you'd expect by chance, that there really does seem to be a connection between the mother and the baby. And this is a very basic form of biological telepathy. It's physiological. The mother doesn't think the baby needs me, and then her milk comes out. What she detects is her breasts start tingling, the milk starts leaking, and she thinks, oh, my baby needs me. It's her body that tells her. It's a kind of basic, unconscious physiological response.
And space really has nothing to do with it. They could be a mile away, they could be 100 miles away, couldn't they?
Yes, that's one of the key features of telepathy. It doesn't seem to be distance-dependent. And this is something you can actually test in our experiments on telephone telepathy, which we haven't discussed yet so far.
Right.
In those experiments, we've done them over distances up to 12,000 miles, the other side of the world, which from here in England, the other side of the world is New Zealand. And these experiments work just as well over thousands of miles as they do with someone in the next block.
You know, one of the things I found, Rupert, is so many people have strong intuitive sense, but they don't act on it. And instead, they don't utilize that gift, that power that they possess. And instead of acting on it, they go with their brain or their gut, perhaps, I don't know what it is, and it's wrong. Where if they use their intuition and reacted to it, chances are they would have been okay. Why don't they do that? Why can't they sense what intuition is and act on it?
Well, of course, some people do act on it, others don't, and I think that one of the problems in our society is that these abilities that we have, these intuitive abilities, which I think are firmly based in our biology, part of our animal nature, these are things over which we have, in which we have no education at all. We're left completely to our own devices. In traditional cultures, people talk about these things, people practice them, they learn about them, they take them for granted. In our culture, as soon as anything like this happens, any educated person feels slightly guilty, because the general view within the academic and educated world is that these things don't happen, that they're all an illusion, that they're only things that ignorant, stupid, or uneducated people believe in. They're superstitious. And so there's a tremendous barrier against these things. It's strongest in scientifically educated people. But it's all educated people have been exposed to this kind of dogmatic skepticism.
Rupert, you say that telepathy is not paranormal, but indeed normal. Explain that for us.
Well, I think that telepathy is part of a normal method of communication among members of animal groups. For example, in a flock of birds, when the flock turns at almost the same time without the birds bumping into each other,
mm-hmm.
although that wouldn't normally be called telepathic, I think what's happening is a field phenomenon. The birds are responding to a field. They're all part of it, the field of the group, the morphic field of the group. In the same way that when you move a magnet, if there are iron filings around, all the iron filings move when the magnet moves because the field they're in changes.
That's a good point. You're right.
And so I think there's something like that going on with groups of animals. And because the field connects members of the group together, this, I think, is the basis for telepathy. If you have something like a pack of wolves, they're very closely bonded with each other. Some wolves have to go away. For example, adults go out hunting, the baby wolves, the cubs, stay behind in the den. It doesn't mean their social bonds dissolve just because they're 100 miles apart. I think the bonds are stretched, the field is stretched, it becomes almost like an invisible elastic band connecting them. And I think that this kind of connection through social bonds is the basis of telepathy. I think it depends on social bonds. It's a way that members of animal groups stay in touch with each other at a distance, particularly to do with things like needs or wants or emergencies. We now have telephones, we even have cell phones, so many people are always connected. But until the invention of the telephone, people were in the same position. The only way you could get in touch with someone when you needed them was through telepathy. And I think it's the basic way in which animal groups keep in touch with each other at a distance. I mean, it also works when they're close together, but when they're at a distance, telepathy is the only way they can keep in touch. I think it has a strong biological role. I think it's very common among animals, and I think it's part of our animal nature. That's why I say it's normal, not paranormal. It's normal also in the sense that it's very common.
Mm-hmm.
Pets, dogs and cats are telepathic with their owners. Most people have had telepathic experiences, and especially in connection with phone calls. It's only called paranormal because from the point of view of standard science, it can't be explained or hasn't been explained. And so some scientists say, well, what's normal is scientific theory as we know it. Therefore, this doesn't fit in with that. Therefore, it's paranormal. It's, I think, the wrong way of looking at it. It's normal in the sense it's biological, it's widespread, it's common in the human population. By all those criteria, it's normal. And I think it's also normal because I think it's a normal part of animal nature.
Do you think in the future, maybe 200 years from now, 500 years from now, assuming we're still around, that human beings will communicate telepathically more than they do with the oral word?
Well, I think that they already do. I mean, I think that the place is not so much 200 years from now, but 200 years in the past. That one would have found this far more than in the modern world, at least in the West. If you go to traditional societies, like when Sir Lawrence Vanderpost was staying with the Bushmen in the Kalahari Desert in southwest Africa, he found that they just took it for granted. And he tells a story in his book, The Lost World of the Kalahari, where he was out hunting with some Bushmen, and they killed some deer, and they were going back in his Land Rover to the camp about 50 miles away. And he said to the bushman, well, won't they be excited when they know we're coming back with some meat? And they looked at him incredulously and said, but they already know. And then they said, we bushmen have a wire here, referring to the telegraph system of white men. He said, we have a, tapping his chest, he said, we have a wire here, we know what others are doing. And sure enough, when they got back to the camp, people knew exactly when they were arriving. They were being greeted, the fires were ready for cooking the meat, people were singing the song that they sing when people come back with game that they've caught or shot. And they all knew. It was just as if someone had called them up and told them. And they took that for granted. So in traditional societies, I think this sort of thing was very common among Native Americans. There are many reports of this sort of thing among Australian Aborigines. And probably in many parts of the world today, although those parts of the world are now being invaded by television and radio and telephones and modern education, things will change fast. But in traditional cultures, these things were completely taken for granted and a part of the normal way of life.
Do you think scientifically electronics, electronic waves, static, might affect this?
I don't think so. Or at least it may do, but the fact is that these things are, I think, increasing in frequency in the modern world because people are so wired up with things like cell phones, which after all create enormous amount of... We live in a kind of electromagnetic smog.
No, that's true.
To an unprecedented degree, and yet telepathy hasn't gone away. Telepathic telephone calls have evolved along with technology. And the latest development of telepathy is the telepathic email, where people know when a particular person is emailing them. So these are things that are happening in the midst of a kind of dense electromagnetic smog. So that makes me think that that's not interfering with it too much. Otherwise, telepathy would be dying out in the modern world. On the contrary, it's not. It's more present than ever.
Let's talk a little bit about telephone telepathy, and then we'll get into the animals during the half-hour portion of this hour, Rupert. But telephone telepathy, and now you also say email telepathy is something that is on the rise.
Yes, I think that we've done surveys in Britain and America that show about 80% of the population have had telephone telepathy experiences. You think of someone, and then they ring, or you know who is calling when the phone rings, even if they're calling at an unexpected time. And of course most people have had the experience of calling someone and then that person says, oh, that's funny, I was just thinking about you.
Exactly.
Very, very common. Now, another new phenomenon that's on the rise is email telepathy, where a lot of people have had the experience, you think of someone and then you click on your send and receive button or whatever you have on your program and there's an email from them. It's very similar to the telephone telepathy, only it happens with emails.
And not only is there an email from them, but they're still on their computer, ready to go with another one when you respond.
Yes. This has become quite common. I mean, it's very similar to the telephone phenomenon, but the technology is different. And we've also been doing a whole series of experiments on email telepathy.
Now, tell me the methodology on that.
Well, I'd better explain the telephone experiments first, because the email one is a kind of variant of it.
All right.
How we do experiments on telephone telepathy is this. We find people who say it happens to them quite often, and then we ask them to name four people it happens with. For example, if you were the subject, George, you would name four people that it might happen with, and typically they'd be people you know well, members of the family, close friends.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd name four people. Then we'd set up the experiments. You'd sit at home. You'd be videotaped continuously. You'd sit with a phone on the table in front of you. Of course, it wouldn't be a cell phone because those have caller ID displays. It would be a regular landline. You'd be filmed continuously. That's to make sure that you wouldn't be getting other phone calls or emails.
Okay.
And that you'd know that there's a particular time when you get the first call for the test, say 10 a.m. in the morning. So at 10 a.m. you're going to get a call from one of these four people. You know who the people are. You've chosen them yourself. at 10 to 10, we pick one of those four people at random by throwing a die. Each of them has a number, and we pick them, and then we call them and say, please call George at 10 o'clock. So at 10 o'clock, the phone rings. You know it's going to ring. It's one of those four people. You know it's one of those four people. But before you pick the phone up, you have to say to the camera who you think it is. Now, I think it's Mary, for example. You pick it up, say, hi, Mary, and you're right or you're wrong. Now, obviously, the chance expectation here, if you were just guessing, you'd be right about one time in four by pure guessing. 25%.
25%, right.
In fact, we've done 1,000 of these trials, and the average success rate is 42%. It's way above the chance level. It's not people aren't right every time. Some are better than others, but this is the average score. But this is very, very significant statistically. I mean, it's trillions to one against chance that people would score that high on so many tests. So we get very definitely above chance results in these experiments, and they seem quite repeatable. We've done these with about 70 different subjects, and about 60 of them have scored above chance levels. Not everyone can do it equally well, obviously, and some people seem pretty insensitive, but these experiments work really well. And so they do provide reliable evidence, I think, for the reality of telepathy. They don't give enormously high success rates, I think partly because the experiments are so artificial. You know, in real life, you call someone because you need to. There's an emotional charge to it, which these experiments don't have. But nevertheless, even though they're artificial, and even though I think we weaken the effect by doing it in this very artificial way, the results are hugely significant statistically and quite repeatable.
What is it about the telephone that allows that to happen? Is it? Is it just merely a vehicle?
Yes, I don't think it's the telephone itself that allows this to happen. I think what happens is that I think telepathy is based on intention in this case. Before you call someone, you intend to call them. Say I was going to call you. I'd think, oh, I've got to call George. I'd usually call you because I had a reason to call you. I'd want to get in touch with you. My mind would reach out towards you. My intention to call you would be there. And the intention, of course, comes before making the actual call. I have the intention. I'd go and look up your phone number, go to the phone, dial the number, and all that time, my mind would be focused on you, wanting to get in touch with you. It's during that period that you might start thinking about me. And that would be because my mind has already reached out to try and contact you. So I think the phone, what it does, it gives us permission to believe we can contact anyone anywhere in the world whenever we like. Without phones, only people who had an enormously strong faith in telepathy or who'd been trained in some esoteric school of thought might have believed that they could contact someone just by wanting to. Telephone enables us all to believe that's possible and to reach out with our minds to people. It's like a byproduct of the telephone that this kind of telepathy happens. So I think telepathy is enormously on the increase in the modern world precisely because these electronic means of communication give us permission and give us the ability, in fact, to contact anyone anywhere. And so our minds reach out ahead of them, and that's when the telepathy happens.
If an individual passes on, he dies in his brain, of course, and no longer functioning, but maybe his mind is still out there. Do you believe that they are still able to tap into this morphic field?
I just don't know the answer to that question. I mean, this is, of course, one of the big questions, the kind of mega questions that people have always wondered about. I personally believe we survived the death of the body, but that's not something I could prove scientifically.
Unfortunately, you can't do the experiments on that one, huh?
No, exactly. No, it's not an area where... there are certain things you can do about investigating what happens after death. I think one of the most interesting areas, one in fact that I'm thinking of working on soon, at least at the stage of the natural history, is the very common phenomenon whereby when people have been bereaved, particularly it happens to widows, widowers, people who've been married for a long time or with a partner for a long time, in the few weeks or months after the person's died, they often get, or sometimes, get the feeling of that person's presence. They see them,
yes,
hear them,
absolutely,
hear their voice. And I've also found through my work with pets, this happens with beloved dogs and cats as well. People still feel them around. It fades after a few weeks or months, but there's a sense of presence that continues. Is this just a trick of memory, or is it some kind of ongoing linkage? I don't know the answer to that, but it's terribly common. And this is an area that's been practically ignored by researchers. There's been a lot of research on spiritualist mediums, seances, trances, and that kind of thing. But this much more everyday, ordinary kind of phenomenon has, as far as I know, been very little investigated, and it's something I'd like to find out more about.
You know, Robert, we have certain basic laws of physics, and we've got laws of gravity. Do you believe that the morphic fields that connects this it falls into that category, or is it something else? Is it something more intelligent, maybe more controlled?
I think morphic fields are phenomena of nature. I think that morphic fields organize all living systems, and in fact I think even crystals and molecules have morphic fields. They have a kind of intelligence, but they're mainly concerned with habits. Morphic fields are principally to do with habits, but they have the ability to organize things in a new way when needed. And you see this with plants and animals. When things regenerate, I mean, if you cut a willow tree into little bits, each of these little bits, each cutting can grow into a new tree. That twig that you cut up into bits wouldn't normally do that, but once it's isolated from the rest, part of it forms roots, another part forms shoots and new leaves. And if a newt loses a leg, some scientists cut them off for experimental purposes, they can regenerate an entire leg. So they wouldn't normally do that,
but
I think these are things that the morphic fields help to organize. They underlie kind of the regenerative powers of living organisms, and you could say that's a kind of creativity, because they sometimes regenerate in a completely new way. Experiments with newts, again, where people cut the lens out of the eye of a newt, creating a kind of damage that would never happen in nature. And the eye regenerates a lens from the edge of the iris, which is not the way the lens grows when the newt's developing normally. It grows from skin on the outside that folds in.
I have a person who sends me a message that says that when she was growing up with her sister, her older sister, would have night terrors and would wake up screaming. And she said it got to a point where she would wake up right before the scream because she was able to pick it up before it even happened. And, there's a connection there, too.
That's very interesting. Maybe telepathic, maybe precognitive. Another case where that often happens, which I have been looking into a bit, is with mothers and babies. I mentioned already that many nursing mothers have a telepathic link with the baby.
Mm-hmm.
But many of them find that they wake up in the night just before the baby wakes and starts crying. They seem to anticipate the baby's needs.
Rupert, you have written a book called Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. How did that happen?
I was intrigued by pets from an early age because I have kept animals ever since I was very young. It always seemed to me there are a lot of things we don't understand about the animals that we know best. And I got interested in so many things that pets do that just seem mysterious. I started collecting people's stories and built up a kind of natural history of what people had experienced with their pets. And there are many, many examples of telepathy involving dogs and cats, and also horses and parrots and other animals. So first of all, I found out what sort of things people had experienced, and then I did surveys to find out how common they were, and then I did experiments to see if these things really happen. One of the things that many people find, for example, is with cats. that the cat seems to know when they're planning to go to the vet. A lot of cats just disappear. Mm-hmm. And I heard so many of these stories, and now then I asked more about it, and they said, well, it's not just the cat seeing the carrying basket, it's not just the cat hearing us talk about the vet, because by the time it's happened a few times, people try to avoid the cat seeing the basket or talking about the vet. Some people even tried making the appointments from work so the cat couldn't overhear the conversation and then swing by home to pick the cat up after work and still wasn't there.
Do you think sometimes, though, that they, because their hearing is so keen, that sometimes they hear the car coming into the driveway way before a human being would, and therefore they know that? Or are we talking about something even more telepathic than that?
Well, I think with cats and vets, I think this is a kind of telepathy. The case where the kind of thing I've tested most of all is dogs knowing when their owners are coming home. Cats and dogs both seem to be able to know, many of them, when their owners are coming home. That, I think, involves picking up their owner's intention to come home, sometimes 10 minutes, even half an hour in advance. In those cases, those are the easiest cases to test of apparent telepathy in animals, because the person is so far away, when it happens, they're many miles away, it can't be the animal reading body language or picking up smells or anything like that. And we found, hundreds of people have found that the dog knows when they're coming home. A lot of people have noticed that the dog will go and wait at a door or a window, or that a cat will, when a member of the household's on the way home.
That's true.
And a lot of households, this is taken for granted. It's just part of normal life, and people just assume, oh, so-and-so's on the way home, the dog's gone to the door. More than 50 women have told me that they have partners who work irregular hours as taxi drivers or lawyers or whatever, and they always know when their man's on the way home because the dog goes to the door, so they know when to start cooking the meal so it's hot on the table when he arrives. So in those cases, at least, it's a useful ability. So what's going on here? If it's only a minute or two before, it could be the animal hearing the crunch of car wheels mm-hmm. on the gravel, or familiar car engine, or footsteps in the street, or whatever. But in many cases, it happens when they're much too far away for that to explain it. It also happens in households where people have non-routine lives. If it was always the same time, you could say, well, it's just a biological clock. They know it's a kind of routine thing. That's where the experiments come in, because this is something where I've done a great many experiments.
With the animals?
With the animals, yes. How we do the experiments is that we put a video camera in the person's home, pointing at the place where the dog waits. We've only done these with dogs so far, not with cats. Usually dogs wait at a particular place, a particular door or window. So we film that area continuously, the whole time the person is out, and it's a time-coded videotape, so we can see exactly when the dog goes there to the nearest second. And this is an objective record. Anyone can look at these videotapes, they'll see the same thing. And in fact, we have the videotapes scored blind by people who don't know the details of the experiment. So the we film the area, and then the person goes out at least 5 miles away. And then what we do in our tests is we have them come home at randomly chosen times.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know in advance when they're going to come home. And, of course, no one at home knows when they're going.
Right.
And we page them on an electronic pager. So they get a message at a time they don't know in advance. It's picked at random. That's the signal to go home. And so there's no routine in these experiments. And then to rule out the possibility the dog could be reacting to familiar car sounds, we have people go home in taxis. And we use a different taxi every time.
So you try to break it up, just in case.
Yes, just in case. I mean, although it's not possible for a dog to hear a car engine from 5 miles away, the limit of their hearing is they can hear higher notes than we can, but they can't hear much further away than we can. And no human being can hear a particular car 5 miles away, irrespective of the wind direction. Nevertheless, skeptics like to say, well, it must be hearing. So you can deal with that argument at a single stroke by using taxes, so there's no familiar car or familiar car smell. And so we have people come home at random times in taxis from at least 5 miles away. And in those experiments, over and over again, the dog goes and starts waiting when the person makes that decision to come home. It usually happens even before they get into the taxi. It's when they've made the decision or they've had the signal to come home. It's the intention the dog seems to be reacting to from many miles away. So we've done hundreds of these experiments with several dogs, and the results are overwhelmingly positive, completely conclusive, statistically hugely significant. This is all published in peer-reviewed journals, scientific papers. And, of course, skeptics have challenged this. One of Britain's leading skeptics criticized me in the media by saying that we hadn't done the randomization procedure properly. There must have been some familiar cars involved. Maybe the people were cheating by sending signals on cell phones that were on the vibrate mode, then causing people at home to activate high-pitched dog whistles that people couldn't hear. And so, I mean, they created all these scenarios of how it could be faulty. So I got tired of arguing about this, and I said to one of these skeptics, okay, we'll go and do your own experiments. And I arranged for him to be able to work with the dog that I'd been working mm-hmm. with at that time. I lent him my video camera. They went along and did the test. They used his car. His assistant accompanied the dog's owner, kept her under constant observation. He stayed with the dog, filmed it continuously. And exactly the same thing happened in my own experiments. In their experiments, they did three of them in the same conditions as mine. And the dog went to the window an average of 4% of the time when the person was away from home, and 78% of the time when she was actually on her way home at a randomly chosen time. And this was very significant statistically. So this has been replicated by skeptics who really didn't want it to work. I mean, they actually would have loved this experiment not to work, but it did anyway.
Did you find that certain animals are a little more telepathic than others?
Oh, for sure. I mean, some species are. I mean, the animals that respond most to people's thoughts and intentions are those that form the strongest bonds with people, like dogs, cats, some horses, parrots. We haven't come across any cases of telepathic goldfish so far, nor snakes or other reptiles. I mean, there may be cases of telepathic snakes, and if any listeners know of one, I'd like to hear about it, because this is an area where I have very little information.
Seems like the reptilian brain doesn't work telepathically as well as the mammalian-type brain.
Yes, I think that may be the case, and that is partly because reptiles are generally solitary. There are very few examples of social reptiles. You know, reptiles normally live in a solitary way. They have to come together to mate, but otherwise they're solitary. They lay eggs. They don't look after the young, so there's no parent infant bonding. And the point you just made about mammals is very important, that mammals, by definition, breastfeed the young, female mammals. That's what makes them mammals. They have mammary glands, and they produce mm-hmm. milk. And all mammals, by definition, the mothers feed the young, and there's this close bond that between the mothers and the young over various periods of time when the young are growing up, which gives an intense social bonding to the mother. Now, there's nothing like that in reptiles. You know, those turtles that swim thousands of miles across the ocean, lay eggs on the beach, and then they go away.
And they're gone, yeah.
They're gone, and the baby turtles hatch out weeks later and have to make their own way into the ocean and so forth. That's typical of reptiles. So they don't have social bonds in the same way. So your point about telepathy not being part of the reptilian brain may be very true. I mean, it's mammals have this close bonding. Even not very social species like cats still have this social bonding between mothers and young, and they still live in family groups. And birds, typically, although they lay eggs like reptiles, because they're warm-blooded, they incubate the eggs, and most bird species, the parents feed the young and look after them. in the way that reptiles don't. And that creates social bonds, and in fact, telepathic bonds can happen between people and bird pets. I mean, parrots are particularly telepathic, but it also happens with a whole range of other bird species.
You know, go ahead.
There is a lot of difference between species, and nearly all the cases, in fact, all the cases I know of telepathy between people and animals are with birds or mammals. None with reptiles, insects.
I was going to tell you my telepathic cat story, Rupert. That individual didn't like his family cat. His wife loved it. And so he decided when she went to work, you know, time to take the old cat away and just drop it off. So he put the cat in his car, drove about a mile, let it out, and by the time he got home, the cat was there on the porch. Just then the wife came home, so he couldn't do much about it. Next day, same thing. She goes to work. He gets the cat, puts it in the car, drives 5 miles away, drops the cat off, and is on his way home again. Same thing happens. The cat is on the porch way before him, just waiting there, and his wife gets home. And he's saying to himself, I'm never going to get rid of this cat. Third day, she goes to work. He goes out 10 miles away, drives over bridges, he's all over the place, lets the cat out. On the way home, he gets lost. He has no idea where he is, and he calls his wife, and he says, oh, honey, let me ask you something. Is the cat home by any chance? And she said, yeah, why? And he said, can I talk to it? I'm lost.
That's a great story. I mean, This ability of animals to find their homes is extraordinary, and most people, you can't do experiments with cats because most people don't want their cats to get lost. In this case, he was trying to get it lost.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very interesting story. That's another thing I've worked on in my book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Unexplained Powers of Animals. One of the other unexplained powers of animals is the sense of direction.
It's incredible.
Which is astonishing, yes. I mean, most animals are far better at this than most modern human beings.
And they get this, somehow, this direction. It's got to be somewhat telepathic because there's no way an animal would know 5 miles away where their home is. Do you think it has anything to do with biological scent at all, or do you think it's telepathic, it's this morphic field?
Well, I don't think it's exactly telepathic, but I think it is a morphic field thing. You see, I think that through morphic fields, organisms link to others in a group. Now, sometimes there are cases where cats and dogs left at home find an owner who's moved away. That's sometimes called psi-trailing. They find someone who's moved away. I think that depends on the bond between the person and the animal. But I think animals also form bonds with places. They connect to their home place, and cats are particularly home-loving. I think when you take them away, it's as if there's an invisible elastic band connecting them to their home, and it gives them a sense of direction. They feel a pull in a particular direction. So it's not exactly the same as telepathy, but like telepathy, it depends on a morphic field. And we're very impressed, of course, when cats and dogs do this sort of thing, which they often do, when people lose them or abandon them away from home. But the most impressive examples of domestic animals doing this are pigeons. And in the United States and here in Europe, there are hundreds of thousands of people who keep pigeons.
Mm-hmm. We call them homing pigeons here.
Homing pigeons.
Yeah.
And pigeon racing is a quite popular sport mainly on the east coast of the U.S., but here in Europe. What happens there, pigeon racing enthusiasts breed birds that are known to be good at homing and can fly fast. And in a typical pigeon race, the birds will be taken about 500 miles away from home to a place they've never been before and released. And they're usually home within the same day. They fly at an average speed of 60 miles an hour. And they know which direction their home is in. There's been a lot of research on homing pigeons, and what it's shown is that it's not doing it by the sun or the sun's position. It's not navigating by the stars. It's not doing it through landmarks. It's far too far away. It's not just a matter of smell. It doesn't depend on wind direction. And even pigeons with their nostrils blocked up with wax can still do it. It does seem to... It's not just magnetism. I mean, they do seem to have a magnetic sense, but that won't explain it. If you're taken miles from home and you're given a compass, you'll know where north is, but you won't know where home is.
Exactly. You may eventually run into it if you keep going the same direction, for example. If you know,
you wouldn't know which direction to go, and if you did it by random search, it would take you a very, very long time.
Exactly.
Miles away. So there does seem to be a mysterious sense of direction at work in pigeons, the most investigated of all animals and the most impressive of homing animals. And I think it's because of this morphic field. And of course, we see the same situation writ large in migrating animals, where there are some birds that nest in the United States or Canada, and then in the autumn they fly right down through Central America, right into South America, thousands of miles, and then they come back the next spring, often to the very same place. And this is like homing with two homes, a summer home and a winter home, over thousands of miles. We don't know how they do it, and these impressive feats of navigation that fish show as well, salmon, for example, we know they smell their home river when they get within a few miles of it, but they're homing from thousands of miles away across the ocean. Smell can't explain all of that.
No, not at all. Do you get help with your experiments in terms of funding, or do you have to do it all yourself?
Well, I do my experiments very cheaply because it's hard to get this kind of work funded. As you can imagine, there's not a penny of taxpayers' money goes on this sort of thing, which is not... lots of taxpayers are interested in it. There's no reason why it shouldn't be.
It's too bad you can't get some government grants, though, or something.
Yes, it's supported by... there's a couple of private foundations support my work.
Good.
And I'm very grateful to them for doing it because they make it possible.
Rupert, the morphic fields... How does it know, and I'm seeing it as if it's alive, but how does it know how and who to connect to? I mean, I'm thinking telepathically about something. It's on the field. There's no doubt about that. How does it know to get to that individual?
Well, there's two ways. First of all, the telepathy usually works between people who there's a bond with. And, for example, between a dog and its owner, they've had a lot of experience of each other in the past. They've been connected through many interactions. There's a kind of memory within the field, the memory of all the past interactions. And that bond is something built up over time. So we're connected with particular animals, with particular people, through bonds that we've built up over time. And those provide the potential connections. We're not equally connected to everybody. We're connected preferentially to some people and to some animals. That's the first step. The second is that there's also the intention involved. In cases where telepathy happens with an intention, like when you have the intention to phone somebody up, then your intention is directed towards that person. And if it's a person you've got a bond with, then there's an existing channel for that to work through. If it's someone you haven't got a bond with, chances are they won't pick it up. Nearly all the experiences people have of telephone telepathy are people who they already know, often people they're closely emotionally linked to.
Well, let me tell you an interesting experiment I used to conduct on myself years ago with people that I didn't have any special bond with at all. But I would do it, I would jump into the morphic field in my dream state, Rupert, where I would think about something so much. And let's say I knew you. Let's say for some reason you were a boss of any particular company that I wanted to get a job for. And I knew of you, maybe I met you once or twice, but I would go to sleep, I would concentrate on that for a few days, maybe a few weeks, and then in my dream state, I'd go to sleep thinking about it, and then I felt that I would get into this morphic field, this consciousness, whatever it might be, and then I let it do whatever it did. And sure enough, maybe in the course of a few days to a week, that person would call me out of the blue and say, you know, hey, someone was talking to me about you. Are you interested in this or that? And it almost happened all the time. What I can't figure out is what was I doing to make it work?
Well, I mean, clearly we're forming an intention directed towards that person, so that element of it was there, the intention. If it's someone you'd already met once or twice, you were, I suppose, intensifying the connection with the person through the dream state. I mean, people are more open to these influences, telepathic influences, when they're asleep or when they're dreaming. To build up the bond, I'm not sure how that would have worked. I mean, I've never heard of this before.
Yeah, and there was no bond. I mean, we weren't friends. It was nothing like that. But
no, but there was an intention.
Yes, a very strong one.
Yes. So the thing is that the bond, it may be the bond's not absolutely essential, but if you've got a very strong intention. But in this case, it was repeated over time and with the aid of the dreams as well as just waking life. I think that's rather unusual. I mean, normally, and I mean, in ordinary conditions, you have both the bond and the intention. And the bond is like a channel's already open. In this case, you had to sort of open up the channel. You had the intention, and you had to create a channel. And in some way, the dreams seem to have played a part in that, or at least doing it at night when you were going to sleep.
All right, let's go to the phones. Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast, you're on the air with Rupert Sheldrake. Hi there. Yeah.
Hello, George. Hello, Rupert. This is Gigi in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hi, Gigi.
My question to Rupert, when I was a student of sociology in college, a common topic revolved around instinct versus intuition versus reflexes. Flock of birds fly south for the winter, and that's instinct, or the behavior of an ant colony is instinct, and the startle response that we have when we have that adrenaline rush is generally defined as a reflex. And I think it's wonderful that you're breaking the dogmatic barrier of normal versus paranormal, but do you think that in light of your research, you could say that intuition is one and the same with instinct, and if not, why?
A good question. Instinct is something that it's an inherited pattern of responses. A reflex is similar, except it's much quicker and more automatic, like the eye blink reflex or the knee jerk reflex. Instincts are inbuilt patterns of behavior, like baby chicks when they imprint on the first moving object and follow it around. That's an instinct. And the ability of a spider to build a web is an instinct. It doesn't have to learn it. Now, intuitions, I think, it may be instinctive to have an intuition, but intuitions are specifically about particular circumstances. You know, a spider's going to build that web whatever the circumstances, come what may, unless it's sort of disabled in some way by the environment. But an intuition is something where we're open to some kind of influence from outside. And it could be an influence from an intuition about that somebody else is looking at us. You could say the sense of being stared at was one form of intuition. You have an intuition you're being looked at, or that you're in danger. You may have an intuition someone's about to telephone. So this word is a very broad word, intuition. It could cover sense of being stared at, telepathy, sense of danger. You could have an intuition that something terrible is going to happen in the next half hour and avoid going somewhere. And that would be like a premonition. That again would be an intuition. A mother might have an intuition that her baby needs her when she's away from it. I think so. Intuition is a very broad word that covers a lot of these things. And you could say that the ability to have intuitions is instinctive or inherited. But instincts are usually more rigidly programmed, and intuitions are usually more flexible responses to changes in the environment or in our circumstances.
Very good. Thanks, Gigi. Appreciate it. Let's go to first-time caller line. Welcome to Coast. You are on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, hi. My name is Nan. I'm in Portland,
Oregon. Hello, Nan, sure.
And I cannot tell you how thrilled I am to be on the air with you, George Knorr. You do such a wonderful job with this program.
Well, thank you.
You inspire me and you give me hope all the time. I'm in my late 40s, almost at the end of my 40s, and you know, that's really sort of no small thing. Mr. Sheldrake, I'm fascinated. I am actually going to get your book and read it. Everything you have cited, talked about in terms of intuition, precognition, and telepathy, I have personally experienced many times throughout my life. And I sort of, you know, have tended to frame those things in terms of the feminine versus the masculine. And the, you know, skepticism and the, you know, sort of derision around intuition, precognition, and or telepathy, you know, because those things tend to be more in the feminine realm as opposed to the masculine, you know, mastery, science, you know, the known versus the unknown. And it's bugged me, and it's really ticked me off throughout my life. I'm just so heartened by the fact that you have actually done studies and are researching this stuff. I think it's really important. And I remember years ago hearing a term morphogenic as opposed to morphic fields. Mm-hmm. And I remember that that was coined because of some studies done, as I recall, about primates and how learning is passed on. You know, when one group of apes learns, or, you know, or even chimps, I think, took on a new behavior, somehow it was passed on to other similar groups, you know, many miles and or continents away. Morphogenic, is the term I remember, and so is there any difference between that and you're talking about morphic fields?
Yes. Well, yes, that is a good question. I mean, the term morphogenetic, actually, morphogenic is perhaps a shorter version of that. The idea of morphogenetic fields is fields concerned with morphogenesis, the development of form. My own starting point was morphogenetic fields in developmental biology. And the word morphic field is a generic term that includes morphogenetic fields. It also includes social fields, behavioral fields, mental fields. So it's really the same idea. And so morphic field is the more generic term. Morphogenetic fields specifically refer to the development of form in developing organisms. So it wouldn't really be the right word for things like telepathy or the transfer of behavior. But it's the same idea, and people often use the words interchangeably, morphogenetic and morphic. I myself used to use the word morphogenetic field more when I first started working along these lines. Then I thought it was clearer to use the word morphic field because it's a more general term. So it's really the same idea, and if you heard those kinds of references to it, they were probably based on some of my earlier work. The story you're referring to with the is actually the so-called 100th monkey story.
Yes, exactly.
The idea that monkeys learned to wash sweet potatoes better if some others had learned to do it. I don't use that story myself, actually, because the factual basis of it's a bit questionable. I mean, the Japanese scientists fed sweet potatoes to monkeys on a beach, and they learned to wash them to get the sand off, and it spread through that particular colony, and then some of them noticed that it seemed to be turning up in colonies elsewhere when they fed them sweet potatoes on the beach.
And no physical contact.
With no physical contact. But the story's been rather exaggerated. It was first told by Lyle Watson in his book Lifetide, and there he makes it clear that he's exaggerating the story. He said, let us imagine that at a particular time a certain monkey, say the 100th monkey, started washing it, then let us imagine that instantaneously it spread everywhere. I mean, he made it clear he was exaggerating it, turning it into a kind of story, but when it was repeated in second and third and fourth hand repetitions, all these qualifications got missed out, and then it became sort of rather lost its grounding in what had really been observed, and then the skeptics found it very easy to debunk it as a kind of New Age myth. Nevertheless, I think that story is telling us something important. I don't myself use the 100th monkey story. I use the 1,000th rat story because Laboratory experiments have shown that there is a spread of behavior with no physical contact with rats. The monkey thing, I think it really did happen, but the way the story is usually told exaggerates it so much that it's easily attacked by skeptics.
East of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Hi, yes, this is David from Huntsville.
Hi, dear.
Hey, I had an experience Sunday working at a bar, and I'd gone to work on Sunday and was talking with a coworker of mine, and I'd wanted to ask her if I could work for her because I'd needed some extra money, and I never did. And later on, when I got home, and it kind of bothered me that I didn't ask her. Anyways, I went to bed, and I had a dream that I was having that conversation with her again, and she said, yeah, sure, you can work for me. I'm kind of worn out from the weekend. You know, that's fine. And so I woke up to the phone, and it was her husband asking me if I could work for her because she wasn't feeling good. And the weird thing about all this is I was thinking that that was so strange, and I rolled over in my bed, and I was like, you know, with my luck, the health department will probably show up today about 3 o'clock, and we'll lose about 5 points because we're so messy from the big weekend we had. And 3 o'clock rolls around, they never showed up, and I was like, oh, well, I guess that's, you know, not going to happen. Well, about 5 o'clock they showed up, and we lost 3 points.
Intuitive. Something works there.
That's kind of strange.
Yes.
Strange, but I just thought I'd run that by you.
All right, it's a great story.
Great show, George, and thank you, Rupert. Great show.
Well, thank you. Thanks for telling us that story.
Thanks a lot.
You know, Rupert, I guess when you said 90% of the people have had this kind of experience with staring, and you look at that, we've all got this intuitiveness in us. Some of us are better than others. Some of us, is it something that you can be trained to get better at?
Well, I think so. For example, in the staring case, in some of the martial arts practices, they have a training on this. I mean, of course, all these things are completely accepted and taken for granted in non-Western cultures. And in the Oriental martial arts, some forms of training involve blindfolding the person who's being trained. And then they'll be surrounded by people in a circle. And then the teacher will pick by pointing to one of the people and ask them to focus on the person in the center who's blindfolded, direct intentions to them as if they're going to attack them, and the person has to point to where they think they're going to be attacked from, where they think they're being looked at from. And in these training procedures, people can definitely get better. So here's a traditional form of training which does increase people's sensitivity. In the West, there are people who give intuition workshops and so on. I've not been to one myself, but there are a few people who do this kind of training. But it's much more traditional in non-Western cultures. So I'm sure it can be cultivated. It can be improved.
Have you seen some cases where someone, for example, is thinking of a song and the person right next to them ends up whistling it or humming it?
Oh, yeah, sure. That's, there are many cases of that. I've not done any actual experiments on that. Telepathy with music seems quite common. There are a lot of people who say they'd suddenly think of a song, switch on the radio, and that song would be playing. And of course, it's not very surprising if it's a very popular song that's sort of high in the charts, because it'll be playing lots of times. But sometimes it's much more unusual pieces of music, and then it's much more striking.
They've got some animals, dogs, for example, that can sense when their owner is about ready to have some kind of major health attack, like a heart attack or an epileptic fit. Is that based on physical things that they sense, or again, are we talking about the morphic field for them?
Well, I don't know. I've been looking into this thing, dogs sensing epileptic seizures. This is well known, and in fact, there are some charities in Britain and in the United States actually training dogs to do this. They give an alert to their person. They warn them they're going to have a seizure half an hour or more before. And this is very useful to people who have epileptic fits because it gives them a warning they can be in a safe place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, no one has a clue how they do it. This is the kind of thing that medical research completely ignores. I mean, they'll spend billions of dollars. The NIH budget's about $23 billion for this year. But not one cent of that is going to things to investigate things of this kind, because it's not high tech, it's not biotechnology, it's not any of the things on the standard. It's very low tech. And yet, I think an investigation of this sort of thing would be really, really interesting.
Let's go back to the phones. Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Dr. Sheldrake. It's an honor to talk to you both. When you talk to Dr. Sheldrake after the program, George, you can tell him I'm the person who had Gretchen the Rat.
Okay.
Dr. Sheldrake, I would like you to talk about the story, I know you're familiar with it, that changed the universe, and that's the one about Nkisi the Parrot, who worked with Amy Morgana. I'm sure you know and remember who they are.
Oh, absolutely. I'm in touch.
I'll listen on the radio while you tell the people about it.
Okay, thank you.
Take care, mate.
Yes, well, this is probably the most remarkable of all the psychic animals I've come across. This is an African grey parrot called Nkisi. That's an African word meaning jungle spirit. And it lives with his owner, Amy Morgana, in Manhattan, New York. Amy was very influenced by Irene Pepperberg, who's a scientist at MIT who's been training an African grey to use language. What Pepperberg has proved is that parrots don't just parrot things, they can actually understand words, they can use words meaningfully, and in using abstract meanings and so forth. Well, Amy, influenced by Pepperberg, started training her parrot using the way you train a child, you know, a baby. You're talking to it, having conversations, showing it things. This parrot now has a vocabulary of 950 words. It's the most accomplished language-using animal in the world. The best one in the Guinness Book of Records is 800 words. Well, Amy's main aim was to find out about animal minds, animal consciousness, and the limits of how far animals could go with using language. She's succeeded brilliantly so far in charting hitherto uncharted territory. But as a kind of byproduct of this, she found that her parrot Nkisi was picking up her own thoughts. She'd be looking at a picture of a car, for example, at the other end of the room, and the parrot would say, "That's a pretty car." It would seem to read her mind. The most remarkable of all were when it read her dreams. It sleeps in her bedroom and quite often wakes her up from her dreams by commenting on what she's dreaming about. So it seems extremely telepathic with her. And when Amy told me about this, I was astonished, and it was off the end of the scale of anything I'd ever heard.
That's a great story.
But it goes on, because I went to visit her in Manhattan as soon as I could, and everything Amy had told me seemed to be perfectly true. I mean, I did a simple test there and then with Amy looking at a picture, a card, in a separate room. And sure enough, within a minute or so, the parrot said what she was looking at. And so Amy and I set up an experiment to test this under more rigorous controlled conditions. We got dozens of photographs selected by a third party, sealed into brown paper envelopes, randomly shuffled and numbered, so no one knew what was in any envelope. And in these tests, Amy was in a separate room on a separate floor with all the doors closed, no sound transmission, filmed continuously. She'd open an envelope, look at a picture for 2 minutes that she'd not seen before. Meanwhile, in another room, we filmed Nkisi, the parrot, to see if he'd say anything related to what she was looking at. It's mind-boggling. In far, far, far more than you'd expect by chance in these trials, he actually says exactly what she's looking at. We have a video that shows this, in fact. She's looking at a picture of a man on the phone, and the parrot says at the same time, in this other room on another floor, "What you're doing on the phone?" And then it makes phone dialing noises, and then it says, "You know, you're on the phone," and talks about the phone. Another picture, she looks at a flower. Picture of a flower, and the parrot keeps saying, "That's a peck of flower, that's what a pretty flower, it's a flower, it's a flower." It's just absolutely mind-boggling, and this I describe in my new book, The Sense of Being Stared At. And in fact, we have a technical scientific paper on these experiments with Nkisi due to be published within a matter of a couple of weeks.
Do you think, Rupert, it's just the parrot Nkisi, or do you think it's the African grey breed that is good at this?
Well, a lot of parrots are psychic and seem to be telepathic with their owners, but the most impressive cases I know of are African greys. I mean, Nkisi is a particularly extreme case, both in the use of language and in these extraordinary telepathic abilities. But I have many other examples that I've heard of from keepers of parrots, and especially African greys, showing that many of them are very psychic. And, of course, it's a key feature of parrots that they bond very strongly to people. I think that's part of the secret of their success in telepathy. They form very strong bonds. Of course, in the wild, parrots are very social animals. They go around in flocks. We don't know very much about the behavior of African greys in the wild, unfortunately. But I think that of all the animals I've come across, they're the stars, and the star of the stars really is Nkisi.
All right, let's go back to some more calls. West of the Rockies, your turn. You're on with Rupert. Hi there.
Good evening, gentlemen. It's a real pleasure to be able to get on the air. Richard here in Las Vegas. George, I wish both of you a really great holiday season.
You too as well.
Thank you. I have a really, Rupert could explain this to me. I've had a great deal of martial arts training, and I've taken remote viewing, which I've never done, and combined it with a healing of hands remotely to help heal someone who had open heart surgery. It made me sick for almost 2 weeks, but I've been recuperating through meditation and everything to get myself back to normal. But it seems to have worked, and I don't quite understand it.
Yes, well, that's really interesting. I mean, I've not heard of anyone who's done this combining remote viewing techniques with healing hands and martial arts background. So you're probably sort of way out ahead of the curve in terms of this kind of thing. There are, of course, studies that have been done on the power of prayer, distant healing, with groups of people praying for people having heart surgery in various cardiac units.
Well, this was right there down on the table with him. I mean, I called and he was not out of surgery, and I went into a very deep meditation and transferred energy with him.
Quite. Well, I think that these controlled experiments that have been done on the power of prayer, they have the advantage that, which you couldn't have done in this case, of a control group. They have some people, they're done like a clinical double-blind placebo-controlled trial where they have some people are prayed for, others are not. Some of these experiments show those who are prayed for get better, quicker, recover more than those who weren't prayed for. In real life, of course, we pray for people we care about. We don't have a control group where we say, well, we're not going to pray for you because we just want to see if you die instead of recovering. So we don't have that control group in real life. Many people pray for others using various techniques. And I think this is a major part of the healing process for a lot of people. Of course, it doesn't always work, otherwise people would never die. But I think it can influence the outcome of events. And there are now these scientific trials that show that in some cases it really does.
We've had some pretty interesting experiments on this program, Rupert, where we've used prayer or mass consciousness to do certain things. And I would say in almost every case we've had successes. Mm. And it started off kind of eerie, but they seem to work. One of the problems we've encountered with some of these, though, is sometimes what you wish for may be too much. If you want it to rain in a drought-stricken area, it may rain so much that all of a sudden it starts to flood. We don't seem to have the control over it yet.
Exactly, yes. I mean, the thing about prayer is, you know, you have to be careful what you pray for, really. If prayer works, it means we have to be very careful how we do it. I know this came up during the period of the Cold War. I was involved in a group that were involved in praying for disarmament, and we were praying about nuclear bases in the West and in the Eastern Bloc. And one group of people said what they envisaged was these nuclear bases being bathed in a blinding white light and filled with light and energy. some of us said, well, actually, that's exactly what would happen if there were a nuclear war.
That's
you know,
true.
It would be filled with blinding white light and bathed in energy. So that wouldn't be the right image. Some of us then came up with the image of imagining these bases dismantled, a bit of rusty barbed wire around, kids playing in areas where, which previously were totally off bounds. So I think we have to be quite careful in, if prayer works, in just what we do, because we might unintentionally sometimes, like in the case of floods, you know, go do the wrong thing.
First time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello.
Hello. First time, and I've listened to Art Bell with my grandparents a long time ago.
Well, welcome to the show.
I used to think y'all were crazy, but now with my four-year-old daughter, she's kind of pointing the stick at me with what's going on. My brother had passed away 10 years ago of an accident sustained at home. I've never spoken of him to her, and telepathy runs in my family because I'm Scottish and American Indian, so I'm really sensitive to this. But with my daughter, she can see things, and she's telling me things about my deceased brother that I have no clue as to where she's picking it up.
Unless she's picking it up from him somehow.
Somehow, some way, I sent y'all an email of a little girl sitting in a chair, and it looked like a gorilla face floating in front of her. And we see these type of things around my house all the time.
Rupert, what about telepathy with the dead?
Well, I think it's a very, very interesting possibility. I mean, insofar as people get communications from dead people, either spontaneously, as in the case of this little girl, or professional mediums who seem to pick up information from the dead, it does imply some kind of telepathy from the dead. Within research circles, the main dispute that people get into is, could it really be telepathy from the living, picking things up that living people know, rather than picking it up from the dead person? I think in some cases the evidence suggests it really is a kind of telepathy from the dead. But of course this goes way beyond the limits of any current science in terms of being able to explain it, including the kinds of things I'm talking about. I mean, it would involve stretching the theories that I'm working on beyond the limits they have at the moment to deal with that kind of phenomenon. So it really is in the realms of the unknown, but nevertheless, people do have these experiences, and it's particularly fascinating that in this case, a three-year-old girl is picking up mm-hmm. this kind of thing, and without any training or anything like that. I mean, I think these things happen spontaneously much more than most of us recognize.
That's pretty compelling. East of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with Rupert Sheldrake. Hi there.
Hello, George and Rupert. I've got some experiences of telepathy and a few other kinds of, I don't know, spiritual phenomenon. And I wanted to bring up and introduce the topic of monatomic gold, because this seems to, I've been taking it for a couple of years,
mm-hmm.
it seems to actually enhance that ability significantly if you know how to do it.
The powder, as Lawrence Gardner would say.
Yes, and it definitely works. I've been studying it, and I think I could tell you a physical theory about what spirit is and what the morphogenic field is.
Well, let's get Rupert's take. We've only got about a minute left, Rupert, so I don't know if you're aware of this, but monatomic powder, which is ground up gold in a powder form, seems to have incredible properties for people. I don't know if you've ever had any experience with that.
I'm afraid I haven't. It's totally new to me. It's something I've never heard of before. I mean, here in England, we're a bit behind on these things. So I'm afraid this is something I really can't comment on. I just don't know anything at all about it.
Go on the website, Google search for Lawrence Gardner, G-A-R-D-N-E-R, Englishman himself, and you can read up on that. And, you know, if it's an enhancer, strictly legal, by the way, it's not a drug. If it's an enhancer, you know, maybe scientifically you might be able to use that as part of your additional experiments. I assume you're going to continue to experiment, are you not?
Absolutely. We've got a whole lot of experiments going at the moment on telepathic emails. And we're testing an online version of the email telepathy program. I hope that within a matter of a couple of weeks, this should be available online on my website.
Excellent.
And anyone will then be able to log on and do a telepathy test with their friends within 15 minutes from logging on. You can do 10 trials. This would really help my research. This would open it up in a kind of really big way. I'm afraid it's not there just yet because we're ironing out a couple of glitches, but by Christmas it should be.
That'll be great to do that. Rupert, thank you so much.